This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. America's presidential candidates are laying out their cases and giving us an idea of what America would look like under their direction. We're going to start the show today by talking about the foreign policy statements coming from the front runners of the two main political parties and what they tell us about America's future international relations. A slew of studies shows that consuming pornography comes with a lot of problems. In fact, legislators in Utah unanimously passed a resolution last month calling pornography a public health crisis. We're going to talk about some of those effects in our second segment. Another crisis today is the rising rate of diabetes. A new World Health Organization study shows that this is a growing problem worldwide. We're going to talk with a nutritionist about how you can avoid being a statistic, and if you're already in trouble, what you can do to reverse the effects of diabetes. And I'll conclude today's show by telling you about a unique date I went on with a special girl. All this on today's Trumpet Hour. You may have heard that America is trying to choose a new president. I loved Richard Palmer's statement on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show a few weeks back. Britain manages to take care of this process in about 2 months, goes at it really intensely for a couple of weeks, and this trumpet writer from Britain earnestly advised Americans to consider taking that route rather than doing it the way that we do, which takes about 2 years. But as the campaign has been going on, we've been getting some insights from the candidates what we can expect from America in terms of foreign policy if these candidates took office. Richard has been watching this drama from his objective perch across the pond in Britain, and he's agreed to share some insights with us. Hello, Richard.
Good afternoon.
So let's talk about the front runner from each of the two political parties, starting with Donald Trump on the Republican side. What have we learned in recent weeks about the way that he would approach foreign policy?
Well, it ties right back in with his long-standing approach that America is a bit of a victim on the world scene. It's getting taken advantage of by everybody, and so he wants America's allies to step up and take care of themselves more. He said, for example, that he wants Japan and South Korea to pay for the United States troops that are stationed there, and if they don't, he wants to pull them out. And perhaps more significantly, over in Japan, he said that he would be completely fine with Japan and South Korea developing nuclear weapons for their own defense instead of trusting and relying upon America's nuclear umbrella. And by a similar token, he said for NATO that he wants that NATO is obsolete, that America spends way too much on NATO. He said the whole thing needs to be either abolished or completely reorganized, but to be very different from what it is now, and basically sees the Europeans as being free riders, spending a bunch of money on their socialist economies while America pays for their defense.
Now, there's a couple of several things that we could talk about with respect to this, but this is a trend that has been going on for quite some time that we've been talking about with Asia and with Europe, that there are a lot of leaders in these theaters that say, we recognize America is stepping back and we need to take more responsibility for ourselves. And essentially, Donald Trump is saying, absolutely, that's absolutely right. Yes, we're stepping back and we're going to continue to do so.
That's right. And especially what he's doing in Europe is right in line with what Mr. Obama has been doing. There's basically the only difference is that of intensity. Mr. Obama has been making statement after statement saying that Europe needs to do more. And he's been sending Joe Biden over there on several occasions and John Kerry to say, spend more, spend more. Mr. Trump would want to do all of that, but then kind of disband NATO and then force Europe to spend more, kind of throw them in at the deep end, and they would have to spend radically more on their militaries. When it comes to Asia, that's, I think, a bit more of a break with current policy. Mr. Obama has at least talked about this pivot to Asia. the current administration's weakness in confronting China has certainly encouraged Japan and South Korea to spend more on their defense and to be more assertive militarily. But I don't think they've talked at all about withdrawing troops, and they certainly not encouraged these nations to develop their own nuclear power.
Maybe you could just remind us how what is the climate and the attitude toward nuclear development in Japan and South Korea as it stands now?
Well, Japan, probably they're the only nation that has experienced a nuclear attack. So they have been historically one of the big pushers for nuclear disarmament. John Kerry was just actually in Hiroshima for a meeting on this subject. However, there was a time where Japan was considering nuclear weapons, actually wanted nuclear weapons. And I think the National Interest had an article on this pretty recently, actually, and America basically stopped that from happening. They do have one of the most advanced nuclear civilian capabilities in the world. It would take them a matter of weeks to become a nuclear power if they ever wanted to. So in some ways, this idea of Japan not having nuclear weapons is a little artificial, because if a war broke out, they could become a nuclear power incredibly quickly, probably faster than any nation on the planet that isn't one currently. So they are a very advanced economy and a very advanced military already.
South Korea, you can definitely see these nations that are sitting there perched in China's shadow having a vested interest in developing that technology.
Yes, I think they've got to tread a little carefully in this direction, because they've got to do so by degrees. So, for example, Shinzo Abe has been relaxing the Japanese constitution. He's been making it so that now, far from making it illegal for Japan to go to war the way it used to be, Japan can now go to war in support of its allies. So one of its allies is attacked, they can then declare war, and that he is gradually loosening the restrictions on Japan going to war. Now, that development was quite unpopular in Japan. There are some pretty major protests. There are some major initiatives to try and get it blocked within the legislature, as it moved forward in the cabinet. Now, if he had come out at the start of that process and said, our aim is for a nuclear-armed Japan that is a major military power in the world, It would have never made it through.
Right.
It would have been shot down right from the start. So there isn't this big open stated public desire among Japan's government to become a nuclear power.
But
you can definitely see them thinking that way. If they're worried about a nuclear attack from North Korea, mm-hmm. they're worried about an aggressive China that is nuclear armed. You've got India's got nuclear arms, Pakistan nuclear arms. They've got to be thinking, to maintain a balance of power when America is pulling out, to maintain our independence from China, when we can't trust in America's nuclear umbrella, when China knows that we can't trust in America's nuclear umbrella, we need to be thinking about this down the road.
And how much would these kinds of statements coming from a prominent presidential candidate from the United States encourage that, or at least bolster the argument that a Shinzo Abe would be making in that direction? So let's go ahead and move on before we look at some of the broader points that we can take from this. But let's look at the Democratic side, the front runner, Hillary Clinton. In terms of foreign policy, there are some things that are kind of similar, maybe a few little differences. Maybe you could tell us about that.
Right. I think if you take a fairly surface look, these two candidates are polar opposites in some ways, because Trump is fairly isolationist. I mean, he still wants to intervene against America's threats, but overall, against threats to America, such as in the Middle East, but overall, he wants to withdraw from the world and let other people handle their problems. Whereas Hillary Clinton in this presidential race is probably the most interventionist, which is a little ironic given that she's coming from the Democratic Party. But fundamentally, they do have the same approach. They would both trust America's allies with more power. They both want America's allies to do more. They would both like to see a NATO that's much more capable. It's just that...
Or a Europe that that's more
Clinton,
capable.
Right. And a Europe that's much more capable. It's just that Hillary Clinton would support that with invading other countries, and actively use America's military to support a powerful European NATO, whereas Donald Trump is more like, well, let's withdraw our forces and let Europe build up theirs. So fundamentally, both trusting Europe, but just a slightly different approach of how they do that. And I think what's most revealing, or the most revealing incident for Hillary Clinton that shows us how her foreign policy would look, is if you go back to some of her biographies of when her husband was president, you had the Monica Lewinsky scandal. The two didn't talk for several months after that. And I believe it was the first conversation after 8 months was Hillary Clinton called her husband up and said, you need to bomb Serbia in support of NATO. And this was very much a German ambition to break up Yugoslavia. It was a European initiative. And Hillary Clinton was very strongly pushing to use America's military might behind this European initiative. And so as a Hillary Clinton president, you could completely see now Europe wanting to do much more in the Middle East and in North Africa after the terrorist attacks, saying, you know, we want to go here, we want to set up a base here. And you could definitely very easily see a President Hillary Clinton saying, America is right behind you, we're going to give you the manpower to achieve these aims.
Mm-hmm. So essentially, the commonality between these two is this desire for these foreign powers and allies that we have in Europe, in Asia, to take more responsibility for themselves, encouraging greater military outlays, more defense spending. Maybe the difference being that Hillary Clinton would be likelier to be there to continue to provide ongoing assistance, a President Trump more inclined to just let them take care of it on their own. But what is it about trusting our allies that might pose a problem? That seems like a fairly logical thing to do.
Well, you look at was it Henry Kissinger, and he was paraphrasing Lord Palmerston, both at the height of the British Empire and then America's policy at the height of America's power, was we have eternal interests but no eternal allies. And there was a very clear understanding that the person who is your ally today may not be your ally tomorrow. And you know, there's nothing there that welds Europe to America. There's nothing there that means Japan will always be an American ally. And in fact, if you look at where geopolitics are pushing, there's actually a lot of forces that are, in the long term, will probably push Japan to be a rival to America within the Pacific. And George Friedman and a colleague wrote a book called The Coming War with Japan, talking about these long-term trends. So trusting in an ally and being perfectly happy to have an ally or these other powers become strong, it's a view that kind of lacks all context. It almost sees the world always being the way it is now and assuming that they are, because they're an ally now, they're just going to keep being that way. Whereas you have a more mature view of history, and that's obviously not the case. Alliances constantly change. Powers rise and fall. The world is always in flux. And I was really glad. I've seen so few people make this case. I was very glad to see over the past couple of days, the American Interest wrote a piece drawing on this history and pointing out, they wrote, multipolar arms races lead to great power war. And that is something you see repeatedly. Two sides of a conflict arm. Both sides realize that if they attack first, they have the advantage. As the arms go up, the stakes get higher and higher and higher, and eventually one power decides to strike first. And that hasn't happened for the past 70 years or so because America has been taking responsibility for the security of the world, so a lot of other nations don't have to.
Mm-hmm. Well, in two senses. One is the fact that American defense spending enables these other nations to have a much lower defense spending. So they're not armed to near the degree that they would have to if they were responsible for their own defense. But also, if you have an America who's looking after a Japan or in any other area where America they would intervene if someone else stepped in, then that really discourages a Russia or some other aggressive power from taking action where they might if it weren't for America's presence.
Exactly. It really helps on both fronts.
So when Donald Trump says, hey, this is a bad deal for America, we're paying more than we need to, he's looking at this purely in economic terms. And I do think that that resonates with a lot of Americans who have this sense of we've been treated unfairly, or what are we getting for all of this expenditure? You know, our debt's through the roof and we have domestic problems. But it is ignoring some of the tremendous benefits that we've experienced over the past 70 years in this period of Pax Americana that could very easily evaporate once America's presence is gone.
Absolutely. And even this view that other nations are not spending, therefore we're being ripped off, is a little short-sighted. Because what if other nations were spending a ton on their military? Then America would feel obliged to kind of keep up in this arms race. They would want to make sure that they were spending much more on their military than Europe was, for example. And so if everybody was shouldering their burden, then actually America may well be spending more on their military right now, because they would want to make sure that, say, a coalition between Europe and Russia couldn't outmatch them. So, I mean, America has been one of the chief beneficiaries of this era of open trade, of open waterways, where there's complete navigation of the sea lanes, etc. So they've developed a lot of benefit from this fairly high level of military spending. But then also, if we had arms races going on right now, they may well be spending more.
This idea that a nuclear-armed Japan, a nuclear-armed South Korea, a far more militarized Europe, that this would lead to a more peaceful world, it really is ironic, particularly when you consider that Japan and Germany were both the Axis powers in World War II. That was the last major world war involved the two powers that America is encouraging to become more militarized today. But, you know, what I also think is interesting is if you look at the political climate in America today, we really are at a crossroads. And the fact that both of these candidates, the front runners of each of the major political parties, are advocating a fundamentally similar position with respect to trusting our allies reflects the mood among Americans today that we've had enough of war. I don't think any candidate who stepped up and said we need to really get more involved overseas would find much traction among the voters.
And you see exactly the same thing in Britain as well. I think in a lot of ways we've been able to get away with it more because America is the predominant military power and not us. But there have been headline after headline about how the British army is at its lowest size since the Napoleonic Wars. The British Navy is no longer even the second tier force that it once was. You know, we have no aircraft carriers. We have completely abdicated any kind of role as a global power and global force for good. And America is wanting to do exactly the same thing, exactly the same pressures. They want to be able to cut taxes. They want to be able to spend money on things like healthcare, on social services. And so that means cutting the military. And so they want to follow in the same path that Britain has followed it gone down. But the implications are much, much more dramatic when the United States does it, because it has been America's military predominance that is in a large part responsible for the era of peace that we've had for the past 70 years.
You produced an infographic for the Trumpet magazine. I'm trying to remember what issue that was in. Was that last October? Where we published...
Sounds about right.
We published the relative military spending of all of these different countries, and I think we kind of went region by region comparing American expenditure with these other countries. And what really was eye-opening to me in that infographic was how quickly the gap is closing. Because we really, I think the sense that America is spending so much more than the rest of the world, I think we spend as much as the next nine nations combined, that is such a dominant narrative. But when you look at how quickly the gap has closed, and then you bring in things like we've been talking about with just how much of that spending in America is misspent and it's ineffective versus what you see in, say, what Russia accomplished in Syria for $1 billion. I think we really see, even as America and Britain are reducing their spending, the rest of the world is increasing its spending, and we're standing right on the doorstep of a very different world, militarily speaking.
We are, and you see a completely different attitude in the rest of the world on these questions. I mean, for example, we just talked about this idea of trusting allies. Look at Russia. Russia, you know, they currently have a pretty good relationship with Germany. They can be pretty sure that in the next few months, Germany is not going to be invading Russia. However, they're still pushing forward into Ukraine. They're still trying to push into Eastern Europe because they know just because Germany is our ally right now, it might not always remain the case. Things could change quite radically over the next 5, the next 10 years. And so other countries are quite obviously thinking this way, and America's not. And you know, look, it's the question of will and the question of diplomacy that and these decision-making skills that matter even more than the money. And they're definitely reflected by the money, and the closing of this gap, I think, reflects different attitudes to the world and world conditions. But there's this great quote from Hans Morgenthal in his kind of big foundational book for international relations, Politics Among Nations, that where he says something like, of all the different components of national power, the quality of diplomacy, and what he means about that is kind of the strategic thinking of a nation, is the most important. And there's such a clear lack of that within America, and that's reflected by the defense spending, and that is reducing America's capacity in the future, but then that's not there for the rest of the world. There evidence like Mr. Putin, a lot of very high quality diplomacy and strategic thinking there. And so it really does put America in a dangerous position.
Fascinating to watch. We've been talking with trumpet writer Richard Palmer about America's future foreign policy based on what we hear coming from the leading political candidates in the presidential race. He's been working on an article about this. You can watch for that to be published soon on thetrumpet.com. Thanks for your time, Richard.
Great to be here.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Pornography is not a harmless time waster. That's a truth that is being backed up by an increasing amount of evidence regarding porn's destructive effects. Last month, the Utah House of Representatives passed a resolution calling pornography a public health crisis. And in the bill, it listed several dozen harmful effects of pornography. I have trumpet writer Andrew Miller here to discuss the latest evidence on this subject. Hello, Andrew.
Good to be here.
So what are some of the effects of porn according to recent studies?
Right. Well, there's just so many you could choose from. I think I'll point out right, friend, we have an article by in the Washington Post by Gail Dines that just really points out that the pornography industry is actually almost very similar to the tobacco industry in that they just have these reams of scientific data that their product is harmful, but they both have very effective public relations campaigns that try to downplay that so they can continue to sell their product. But no, there's really been, especially in the past 40 years, journal after journal publishing peer-reviewed scientific papers on the harmful effects of pornography. One of the claims they've made in this Utah resolution is the link between pornography and rape or sexual violence. Just this, that once especially men, but it could be men or women, they just get into this world of online pornography where it gets more extreme and more extreme and more extreme until they almost actually have to do some of the things they've become addicted to online to get that same excitement level or kickback, or chemical kickback that they're looking for. There's one study, this was actually published in the Journal of Sexual Addiction and Compulsion, that found that college men exposed to mainstream pornography within the past 12 months were more likely than the control group for the study to admit that they would commit rape or sexual assault if they knew for sure that they couldn't get caught.
If they couldn't get caught.
Right.
That was the operative word. They would do it if they could do it without any consequences.
Right. They knew if they'd get,
That's the ultimate in self-interest. It's not out of concern for the other person. They would take advantage of the other person as long as they knew that they would be fine.
Wouldn't get caught. And I mean, in some cases, I mean, they have had like serial rapists and serial killers tried who've tried and executed, who've gotten to the point where even getting caught's not a concern for them anymore. They're so addicted to this that they almost can't stop themselves. It's like a chemical.
Okay, so you're talking about some pretty extreme cases. There would be a lot of people who would say maybe be, I don't know, less severe users of pornography. Are there studies that show, say, even the effects that it can have on someone who isn't going to the extreme of committing those kinds of criminal acts?
Right. Well, I think the most recent studies estimate there are probably about 40 million people in the United States, a little over 10%, who they say are actually addicted to, physiochemically addicted to online pornography. And there's probably an extreme from amongst them that are so addicted that they've just been plunged into like this world of rape and sexual assault. Now, for the rest of the population that's not to that extreme, there are still other symptoms that they've got studies to back up, and just in the negative effects in their life. I think there's another study done, not too long ago, looks like about 2012, published that this is especially focusing on like women who were in relationships with men addicted to porn, and just the effect that had on their self-esteem, the quality of their relationships, and even the likelihood of a divorce. Actually, they did a survey in 2002 of America's top divorce lawyers that revealed that over half of the divorce cases in America always involve a spouse who's hooked on an online pornography site.
So they can tell the effects in terms of family division. It reminds me of the passage where Jesus Christ in Matthew 5, he was talking about the fact that adultery isn't necessarily just the act. He said, whoever looks on a woman to lust after her, he has committed adultery already in his heart. And that's really kind of at the essence of this. There are a lot of people who would say it's a harmless thing to do, or it's even healthy to do, but the statistics show that it really does split families up.
Absolutely. Like I said, I mentioned earlier, it's probably more like getting closer to that 10% that's just really addicted, where you start getting like the sexual aggression and that more extreme crimes against society. But there's also, I think, I don't have an exact statistic for how many, but it's probably close to like 80-90% of men who use it what they'd consider more casually, but that still has it might not lead you into a world of rape at that rate, but it's definitely has scientifically proved effects that making you more likely for a divorce, hurting your family life, hurting your relations with your spouse, getting back to, like I said, that verse you'd quoted from the New Testament.
So what are some of the other effects, and what would even be maybe some of the things that would lead to the family problems and the fracturing of the relationship with the spouse?
Right. And then for the divorce standpoint, this resolution in Utah just really draws the link between that and infidelity to where it is. I mean, even though it's not, like you say, a living, breathing affair, you are still having an extramarital affair with an emotional
fact,
with an actress on your computer screen.
Yeah.
That at the end of the day, it's really just about the same emotional effect on your, takes the same emotional toll on your marriage as if you really just did commit adultery with someone who lived down the street.
And the studies that you're looking at, and the studies that the Utah House of Representatives is looking at, they are backing up that claim. It's one thing to resort to the Bible and to say, well, this is what Jesus Christ said. These people aren't quoting scripture. They're just looking at the evidence.
Right. The evidence definitely shows that there's definitely at least a strong correlation between those who are into the world of online pornography and those who are having relationship problems that are ending in divorce. Or even going back earlier than that, this Utah resolution points out a lot about like children or teenagers as young as 12 getting hooked on online pornography, and even shows that this is starting to become a big driver for, especially with young men, convincing them that they don't need to get married in the first place.
So it's actually contributing to the suppression of marriage rates.
Right, with if you can get whatever sexual satisfaction he thinks he needs from a computer screen, I mean, that is just one more reason in his mind where he thinks, well, maybe I don't actually need a real spouse.
So maybe you could just give us some more of the was it just a bullet point list that the House of Representatives was looking at in terms of the negative effects of pornography?
Right. I mean, it's a couple page document, so there are a lot of lists. But I've got an article summarizing it that should be going up on thetrumpet.com tonight that brings out low self esteem, problematic sexual activity at younger ages, lessening desire in young men to marry, infidelity, abuse of women and children. We've talked about all those things already. And then it even brings out some more extreme things like prostitution and sex trafficking, that those are towards the more extreme edge, but they get that if you create a demand, you'll create a supply, and not everyone in the pornography industry is a willing participant.
Well, yeah, and not to mention the fact that, say, those it's easy to look at some of those more extreme problems that are associated with pornography and say, well, I would never do that. But you have to think every single person who's involved in those more extreme behaviors started with in the same way that everyone else did. It's not a matter. Nobody said, yeah, I'm going to go in this whole hog and go as far as I can in that direction. It's a step-by-step progression that leads someone from more casual use into more extreme use.
Right. Well, because then, first of all, even the more casual users, they are still creating a demand that's financing an industry that maybe for someone else isn't this extreme thing. I mean, you're still financing that. But second of all, I mean, I do point out in this article the more famous example of Ted Bundy, a serial killer and rapist executed in 1989, who he had James Dobson, the folks on the family founder, got in to interview him just before his execution. And he said, no, it's like I said, I started out normal guy, normal friends, normal life, got into this pornography kind of on the side. It got into this this addiction to where eventually the images we're seeing weren't as his it was a chemical. You overstimulate your brain with dopamine and your body dials that back because it realized, okay, this is too much. And then, but you're wanting the same effect. So you go into something more extreme to get that same dopamine level. And then something like that, but it just gets worse and worse and worse until eventually he got to the point in the interview where he just admitted, he said there was nothing online, or I guess that it wasn't online in 1989, but there was nothing I could find in the printed world of pornography extreme enough to satisfy this addiction. I had to actually get into actually doing the things that I was watching.
And this was pre-internet, and what's now is far, far worse. You know, I have a suspicion that it's really interesting the fact that this information has been around for so long, because there's been such a concerted effort to portray pornography as a harmless pursuit, and that it's a lot of people saying that it's actually beneficial in more recent years. Even as this information has been available and this preponderance of evidence showing the negative effects of it. But I suspect that this information isn't going to have a huge impact on people's behavior. I've just been studying the effects of processed food. We're going to talk in the next segment about diabetes coming from an overconsumption of refined sugar. And yet that information, as available as that is, as obvious as it may be, people keep consuming it in huge amounts. It doesn't seem to have much effect on people's behavior, and I would suspect that the same would be true with this. People seem to want to hold on to their addictions. We've been talking with Andrew Miller. He has an article called Utah Declares Pornography Public Health Crisis. You can find that article online at thetrumpet.com. Thanks a lot, Andrew.
Good to be here.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
Diabetes is a fast-growing epidemic globally. The number of adults with diabetes almost quadrupled worldwide over the last generation. That's according to a report from the World Health Organization released last week. In 1980, 108 million adults had diabetes, and by 2014, that number was up to 422 million. That's about one out of every 12 adults worldwide. to talk about what is causing this epidemic and what you can do about it, we have registered holistic nutritionist Jorg Mardian via Skype from his office in British Columbia. Hello, Jorg.
Hi there.
So, first of all, maybe you could just give us a definition. What is diabetes?
Well, there's three main types of diabetes. We have type 1, where there's no known cure. That's where the pancreas stops producing the hormone insulin. We have type 2, which results from the body's ineffective use of insulin. And that's what most people have. And of course, you also have gestational diabetes.
Gestational diabetes for...
during pregnancy.
Okay. So, but type 2 is the most the most common, and has this WHO report, did it talk about which type it's referring to in this skyrocketing of the incidence of this disease?
Yes, that was type 2, and they say up to 80 to 90% of people are type 2 diabetic.
Okay, so what are the health implications? How dangerous is diabetes? What happens when someone is diabetic?
It's actually pretty grave. The type 2 diabetics are 2 to 4 times more likely to get cardiovascular disease. And 80% of those are said to die prematurely by an estimated 12 to 14 years. Mm-hmm. And then there's other repercussions, of course, which include nerve damage, infections which can lead to amputations, blindness, kidney failure, and as well increased medical costs, which can be as high as 2 to 5 times higher than the average person.
Okay, so you're talking about some of these things, say conditions or diabetic condition leading to other problems, health problems, and so on. If the body isn't using insulin properly, what happens, say, within our bodies? Why does that create problems?
Well, what happens is most of this is fueled by sugar. And sugar, we have to be very careful because it affects the hormone leptin. And leptin, really, what it does is it allows us to feel full. So let's say we gain weight, then that hormone will, you know, ride into the rescue and say, well, you're feeling full. But sugar actually overrides that, which is very unique. And it's so... let's say we're gaining weight, we actually still feel hungry then, and we continue to keep eating. So it's quite unique because everything today has sugar in it. So, and I'm not just talking about normal fruits. I'm talking about high fructose corn syrup. I'm talking about normal fructose. Refined grains, sugars, all processed foods, and all of those will override those signals built in by the body to satiate us. And they just, you know, the more we eat of that, the more hungry we feel, and the more we eat, and the more we gain weight. And here's the crazy thing about it. Diabetes has risen in parallel to the epidemic of obesity. Parallel. And 80 to 90% of people who are diabetic are also overweight or obese.
Okay. And so you're saying that there's a strong correlation between a improper insulin response and overeating because you just don't get that signal that you've had enough.
That's correct. Yes.
So diet, in terms of the causes of diabetes, is the biggest cause, I'm gathering from what you're saying.
Well, diabetes is the way it's put today. It's to a large degree a manifestation of our flawed modern society. We've got everything. Well, rapid urbanization, unhealthy foods, and sedentary lifestyles are fueling this, and not just here, but in China, in India, and developing countries all over the world. And the World Health Organization is actually alarmed over this, you know, saying, look, this is a crazy epidemic and it's supposed to double in the next 20 years. And get this, the statistics are so big that they're saying it could cost up to $827 billion annually for this disease globally. And the World Health Organization admitted in its first global diabetes report that the disease could actually threaten the economies of all nations. Now, that's crazy.
So you were talking about processed food being a real culprit, and you specifically mentioned that. Urbanization, that's an interesting cause that you mentioned. In what sense is urbanization contributing to the problem?
Well, we have a lot of sprawl, but not enough spaces to really get out and get busy. So we're side by side and houses are stacked next to each other forever. But do we have enough spaces to really, parks to play in, you know, and are we putting a priority on where kids grow up and have a good time, or are they just in front of their house where they're not really out running with other kids? And so we're not really building these places with in mind that, hey, we need to move. We're building them because we have a lot of people in one space. Like, say, the cities are getting bigger and bigger, but they're not really giving us more space to move. So that's really what they talk about.
Strong correlation with just the sedentary lifestyle that you're talking about.
Absolutely. Exercise is just a big part of it. Actually, exercise has been shown to be one of the more powerful ways of getting diabetes under control, because it actually controls the number of insulin receptors in the muscle and the sensitivity of the body to insulin, which helps the pancreas, releases it of the burden of constant production of insulin.
Okay, so we're really starting to get into what you can do about this. And we, in our last interview, I guess last month, we were talking about obesity and just how many of the associated problems with obesity are they're lifestyle related, and how this is really one of the leading causes of preventable disease. With diabetes, you're really talking about something that it's choices, it's lifestyle that are contributing to the problem, and it is preventable through changes in lifestyle.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, that's proven. And I'll get back to the two basics we talked about last time as well. It's exercise and eating properly. And the scientists are now showing that even a 10-pound loss, a 10-pound weight loss, can keep your blood sugar levels within a healthy range and reduce complications. But further, you can actually reverse diabetes or come off medications altogether. So they say if your diet, if you have a normal dietary range with 1,200 to 18 calories a day, they show that 10% improved to where their blood sugar levels were no longer in a diabetic range. But even more exciting, 15 to 20% of those were able to stop taking diabetes medication altogether.
So the diabetes medication, is that primarily basically replacing insulin production within the body?
That's what it is. And that's part of the problem with that is it gives a false sense of I've got my blood sugar under balance and therefore I'm okay. And then I'm okay to keep doing what I'm doing. And I see that all day long. But really, we have to get back to what we just discussed. What are we doing to change our lifestyles? Are we trying to get the better of this, or are we just managing? And we'll get back again to the complications I talked about. They're horrific. I mean, we've all heard of people who have suffered, like, say, blindness or amputations because of that. And who really wants to shorten their lifestyle or their life by 15 to 20 years? Nobody wants to do that. So I think people really have to look at this as a grave disease, and it is a danger to your life.
Right. Not only shortened lifespan, but severe reduction in quality of life. If you're talking about blindness or impaired vision or the kinds of problems that would result in an amputation.
Yes. We're seeing people now younger and younger getting diabetes. And what I'm seeing is when I do counsel these young people is they just don't understand how bad this disease is. And they keep taking in sugar. And then they say, well, my range is normal now. Now I can take some and I know I'll get it under control by looking at how much medication I need. But that's the wrong way to look at it. You're not looking at it long term. And really, these young people need to be educated because in, you know, 10, 20 years, they're going to have some big problems.
You're, I would imagine, not only as a nutritionist, but also as a personal trainer, dealing with people who are, maybe they go to the doctor and he says, look, you're pre-diabetic or you're diabetic, you need to do something about it. They get this wake-up call. They say, okay, I'm going to look up in the phone book and find somebody that will help me to get in shape. They come to you. They ask for help. What sort of prognosis do you give to the person who's been given that kind of news in terms of what they can do to reverse the effects of diabetes on their bodies?
Right. Well, one of the things that I never say is, look, this and this will happen. I mean, you can get into some fairly big trouble like that. A safe way for me to say is, look, I've been doing this a long time. I know that if you eat good and you exercise, good things will happen. I won't tell you the extent of it, but this is what I've seen over 10, 11 years. And I've seen some pretty amazing things, even turnabouts. And so I can quote my clients who have had success. We never know what happens exactly with an individual. And I really don't know what they're doing away from me. So you can't predict what will happen. But we can say for sure, look, we know some really good things that will happen. Just see what happens when you start. And then the other thing is you must be consistent. Consistency is lacking in probably 80% of individuals. And that's why they really don't see success. They get a scare and they're good for 2 or 3 weeks because they've been scared by their doctor. And then they come to me, they see some fairly good results within a couple of weeks, and then they tail off, boom, because they feel a little bit better. And that's really the time to keep going.
That's the way our human nature is, isn't it?
That's right.
So can you tell us some of the individual cases that you've seen in terms of what kind of success or what kind of turnaround is possible with consistent effort?
Speaking specifically of diabetes?
Yeah.
Right. So within a week, I've had some people that have been on medications, even type 1 diabetes, where it's said that there's no known cure. And of course, I've never been involved with somebody that's had a cure through type 1. But we have seen a big drop in medications on type 1 diabetes. A big drop. And that's just, you know, thanks to that lifestyle change and better eating. And in type 2, we have seen here that people have been able to eliminate their medicine. And that's actually proven by science. I mean, that's a no-brainer. If you eat good and you cut out all the processed sugars, the processed foods, the myriad of carbohydrates that are refined, your body's just going to respond and start doing what it's supposed to be doing. And then your blood sugar is going to stay in a stable range and you start feeling better.
Any other tips that you could give to the person who's concerned about this in terms of protecting yourself or even beginning that road to recovery?
Well, the thing that will make or break you is the lifestyle. I mean, and we've hammered this for a few programs now, no matter the subject. It's back to lifestyle, lifestyle, lifestyle. That's what breaks you, and that's what can make you. I would tell people, be mindful of your day-to-day habits and stick to whole, unprocessed foods and get your body moving to avoid being a statistic.
How much exercise would it take to kind of put yourself in a safe zone or to inoculate yourself against being susceptible to diabetic conditions?
Well, exercise wise, you should get, I like 3 or 4 days a week. If it's a half hour a day, it should be fairly vigorous. Vigorous exercise is the best, even a walk, vigorous, not just a slow walk. If you can do 45 minutes, that's even better. You don't have to overdo it. I mean, people just don't have to go out there and say, you know what, this is intimidating to me, I can't do it. Anything you can do is helpful. The body is moving. And then, of course, that's a part of the formula. And the other then is make sure you stock your pantries with foods that are whole and unprocessed as much as possible so that your body can help you and regenerate the cells and the breakdown of muscle tissue from the exercise. The two go hand in glove.
Well, we've been talking with registered nutritionist Jorg Mardian. He's talking to us about the effects and the some of the things that you can do to protect yourself against diabetes. He's written an article about this for The Trumpet magazine. We look forward to reading that. You can find that in the upcoming days on thetrumpet.com. Jorg, thanks as always for your time.
Thank you.
It's time for today's last word.
I'll never forget my first date with one of the women in my life. It was unlike any date I'd ever been on. The way it began may give you an idea of what I mean. When I came to pick her up and I gave her some flowers, she said sweetly, "These are too big for me." And I had to teach her to take hold of them and to thank me. Now, in her defense, it was her first date. And even though she committed several similar gaffes throughout the evening, it was still an exhilarating event for me. And it only cost me $12, which included the flowers, dinner at a local taco stand, a ride on the swings at the park, and a trip to the pet store to buy a black Molly. By the end of the night, my heart was swelling with a deeper love for this special girl, and I could tell she was more smitten with me too. From that point forward, I determined to take my oldest daughter, who was 2 years old at the time, out on a regular basis. And her little sister, too, whose vocabulary at the time didn't include actual words. I've learned that everyone needs praise. Everyone needs to feel appreciated and admired, especially our impressionable children. Sometimes we can get into a bad cycle of always seeing only their mistakes and always correcting them. Like many parents, I'm sure I've found myself slipping into that trap from time to time. Some years ago, the Trumpet's editor-in-chief, Gerald Flurry, wrote about three basic ways to properly develop a child's attitude: love, teaching, and discipline. And he recommended applying these tools in this proportion: 85% love, 10% teaching by example, and 5% correction in love. 85% love. That's a lot of love. 1 John 4 and verse 19 says that we love God because he first loved us. Mr. Flurry wrote, "It follows that we as parents have to love our children first. You cannot force your child to love you. Your child's heart can only begin to turn toward you if you love him or her first." Now, God wants the hearts of parents and children turned one to one another. You can read about that in Malachi 4 and verse 6. Mr. Flurry wrote, "If all you do as a parent is discipline your child without love, then you will raise a hostile child who, when grown, will not be turned to dad and mom. If the dad leads the family in love, then the children are more likely to return that love." Now, that doesn't mean being permissive. You still have to enforce the law. But it's amazing how much an accumulation of positive experiences, like a father-daughter date, improve a child's responsiveness and obedience. After all, we are teaching our children an attitude toward authority that they'll carry through life. We're teaching them how to view God. "Our children truly belong to God," Mr. Flurry wrote. "He expects us to raise them so that they'll turn to him spiritually when they are grown. To do this, we must make it easy for our children to love us." Make it easy for them to love you. That's fantastic advice. That first date with my first daughter was the beginning of, well, a kind of courtship. She'll turn 15 years old this summer, and we're still dating. I'm Joel Hilliker, and we're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. If you like this program, we want to give you a subscription to the Trumpet Magazine. This is our monthly news magazine featuring the writers you hear on this show. To receive the Trumpet every month for free, go online to thetrumpet.com. You can also go there for daily analysis. on the events of the day and how they fulfill the Bible's prophecies. Send your thoughts on the program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. I want to thank my guests today, Richard Palmer, Andrew Miller, and Jorg Mardian. And I'll leave you with this thought from Harry Emerson Fosdick. No gas or steam ever drives anything until it is confined. No Niagara is ever turned into light and power until it is tunneled. No life ever grows until it is focused, dedicated, disciplined. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.